Welcome to the Your Voice podcast, brought to you by ebodyguard.org and the eBodyguard app, available wherever you buy apps. Your Voice is a podcast empowering women to become a victor over victimization. We're changing the conversation about domestic violence and victims of trauma in America. This is Your Voice with hosts Melissa Faith Hart and Melissa Moore.
It's Melissa Moore and Melissa Faith Hart. Welcome to Your Voice. It is a podcast about changing the voice, changing the conversation about domestic violence. And we are so excited this week to have Ms. Ruth Glenn. She is the CEO and president of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence here. And previously, she was employed by the Colorado Department of Human Services for 28 years. And she served as the director of the domestic violence program for the last 9 of those years. We're retiring in 2013. And she has worked and volunteered in the domestic violence field for over 25 years. Ruth, did I get it all covered?
Yes. It's always embarrassing when anyone reads your bio, but yes, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us this week for the Your Voice podcast, which is sponsored by ebodyguard.org. Get the free app on your phone. It is your best defense to make sure you've always got 911 right there in your pocket. And it's a great app, too, because it's absolutely free. So look for the eBodyguard app on wherever you get your apps on social media. All right, Ruth, we're going to start out first. Melissa Faith Hart has some questions for you. And then I kind of want to dive into, because everybody always has a story about how they got involved with domestic violence. And we'll talk about that in the second half of this interview.
Okay, fantastic.
Thank you, Melissa. And so, Ruth, I want to talk about what you really understand, which is domestic violence, and in specifics this month, really centered around PTSD. And July happens to be PTSD month.
Right.
So in order to really get the understanding around PTSD, I want to go straight at the heart of it, which is the numbers of people that are impacted by sexual assault and domestic violence. Do you think America in general understands the amount of people that are impacted by domestic violence, in particular sexual assault?
I don't think that our society understands at all the crisis of violence against women, but particularly domestic violence and sexual assault. Those are crimes against persons, but for many sundry reasons, of which we can have probably 12 more podcasts, we still have a society that either ignores it, doesn't want to admit it, and or glosses over it in a way that is very, very harmful for those that experience domestic violence and sexual assault. And I worry about the little girls especially, and the little boys that we're raising that may have to experience it, because we're not treating it like the public health crisis that it is.
This apathy, this glossing over that you talk about, and the sheer numbers of individuals that are being impacted by not just the apathy, but also the actual tentacles that come after the events. What do you think the implications are by our lack of response?
Well, I think we have a hurt nation of women. I think we have women who are walking around with the after effects, if they were ever able to get on a safe journey, right? And they're walking around hurt in different ways, but hurt. I think when we're talking about numbers and we're talking about the sheer number of women who experience violence against women, I think we forget the cost to our society, right? Yeah. Hospitals, medical centers, loss of productivity for jobs. How many times, I know in my own experience, I called in several times. I mean, that's lost productivity to a job place. What is it costing for first responders to be there when and if they're being called? You know, we're spending dollars that if we could take those dollars and use them for something else, that would be grand. But talking about the sheer number of women, it's always amazing to me, even in this job, that even as CEO, there are victims that reach out directly to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just mind-boggling that we're not understanding and not doing something more proactive about this nation of hurt women, and lots of them.
Yeah, these second order impacts that you're referring to, the cost, the actual economic cost.
That's right.
That we're really bearing as the citizens, and yet we pay for it, right?
That's right.
I want to go directly to the heart of the pain that you talk about, and that's the PTSD that, mm-hmm. you know, we read about,
yep.
we hear about. These are four letters that people say, oh, PTSD, that's a veteran issue. That's a military issue, that if you go to war, people that have, you know, been hurt because they've been in a combat situation, then they might have PTSD. Can you break down for us and maybe some listeners out there what a female who's been through a domestic violence situation and a sex assault situation, what a trigger of PTSD actually really is? Can you walk that out for us?
Sure. And quite frankly, I can tell you that I suffer from PTSD pretty badly. And there are days that are worse than others, certainly. I've been removed for a very long time. But I will tell you that that's another cost we don't talk about, is the PTSD that occurs where, you know, we have women who are triggered by sounds. We have women who are triggered by a certain type of person. They may not be able to get in an elevator because there's a person that resembles their assailant. They may stop their car from driving while they're driving home and pull over to the side and just cry because they're not even sure what the trigger was. The amount of what we spend and the women that need to get therapy. And I want to be very clear, we don't suggest you need therapy to escape domestic violence or to stop a sexual assault. We're talking about what you're talking about, Melissa, is the after effect.
Right, the aftermath, yeah.
The aftermath. I always reckon, I've told my story for 20 plus years, but I always talk about domestic violence in the context of being a POW. Mm-hmm. You are a prisoner of war. You're hypervigilant, always waiting for the next thing to happen. And then when that's removed, you don't know what to do with that, and it becomes a part of your fiber until you're able to get a lot of assistance with that. If you're always waiting for the punch, if you're always waiting for somebody to take your keys away from you, if you're always waiting for the garage door to open because you don't know what that person's going to be coming into the home like. This is the point, too, where oftentimes I agree with you. I think we talk about PTSD in the context of war and mm-hmm. combat. And we forget that the assault on our personal being is so much more than the assault on our physical being. You know, I've talked to many survivors over the year, and they will tell you that the PTSD and the after effect that they feel, the aftermath that they feel, is certainly more psychological than it is physical. And I'll never forget one in particular told me, she said, you know, I may not even have a bruise the next morning from being hit, but I'm still recovering from the bruises on my mind and my psyche. Mm,
you know, I'm... Go ahead.
Never forgot that because it's absolutely true.
It's so true. And I thank you for being vulnerable, because Melissa and I have both shared with each other, and she will go into more detail with you in her with her questions with you. But we've shared with each other that we have both suffered from PTSD. And with our EMDR and my EMDR therapy, I've been able to resolve and calm many of my triggers. But even the other day on a walk, a car drove yeah. by. And you know, some of those cars that don't get their mufflers taken okay. care of right. and they can pop, you right. know what I mean? Oh. That caused a somatic flashback in my system
okay.
that literally, like, I wasn't calm for the next, like, I think it was about 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a somatic flashback to just, you know what it is, but for those people that might be listening, it's you literally feel it in your body, yeah. right? And you might have that trigger all the way back to when yeah. you were a kid, when your dad, right, hit you with the belt and you heard the belt buckle, right? right? And, yeah. And those are the types of things that EMDR therapy can help you calm down. Right? That first time that the trusted person in your life who's supposed to love you and nurture you, yeah. but it's actually the perpetrator. So what did you learn about trauma-informed therapy? So we're going to take the next journey together now and talk about the healing path of PTSD. Right. What did you learn helps with healing?
Well, and I think you really do have to find the therapeutic means by which helps, right?
Yeah.
You have to find a new purpose, because yeah. the other thing is a purpose of staying alive, not being hurt. Those kinds of things have consumed you, and now you have to find where else to put that energy. Mm-hmm. Mine was getting involved in domestic violence, but I do have to comment on one thing. I dislike July 4th. The triggers are just horrible. And so, you know, you hear people talk about PTSD and they talk about it in all these other contexts. And I just want to jump up and yell and say, me too, because I can't stand it. I did not go through EMDR. And in fact, I was part of a survivors group, and one of the survivors suggested to me regressive therapy. So, you know, taking me back to a couple of instances and then having me walk through it and have it come out on the other side differently. And that absolutely worked for me. But I also know that there are many modes of therapy out there that can help people. But, you know, if I have any advice, and I'm not the only one, so survivors tell me all the time that their journey is individual. Mm-hmm. They choose how that is. Many of them don't go to therapy, though a lot of them do. Finding themselves again through writing, or having the freedom to be loving and caring with their children like they've always wanted to do, or going to visit their families, or getting a new job, or going back to school, which is what I did. I was always told I couldn't go back to school, mm-hmm. and I did. So everyone finds what it is. We have to encourage them that there's something on the other side of it, which most of our DV programs do a really good job. You're here to be safe. You're here to get safe. This is not the end. You as a person have so much to offer, and you may find that you've got things that you've always wanted to do, or now that you have the freedom to kind of move and even find out what that is. So
your regressive therapy sounded a lot like what EMDR does and takes you and walks you through those memories. So I love what you said, that it's individual, right?
Yes.
And what your journey looks like is not what Melissa's journey looks like, is not what my journey looks like. And it's really important that I don't pressure you and we don't pressure anyone else, because my healing journey was my healing journey.
Right.
Right. And it's safe for me to explore what now my new purpose is in order for me to feel that safety and that love to be me. Right. Because I didn't get that. And you didn't get that.
Right. You know, the other thing to really remember is I tell people all the time, never tell a victim to leave, or never tell a sexual assault person to get or a victim to get over it. Everyone does that differently. And not only that, but how disempowering is that to say that to them? They have the power to leave when they want to. They should. They know when it's safest. We need to trust them to make their minds up about that. We need to allow people to grieve within their own space. So it's really disempowering when we begin to say, well, you should go to EMDR, or you should do this, or you should do that, without saying, you know, I found all of these resources. I'm going to leave them on the coffee table for you just in case you want to look at them and determine that. Or if you ever want to talk, I have a friend who does such and such, and we can make that happen. So it's really empowering survivors.
I love that.
Yeah.
Choice, basically.
That's
so my
right.
last question for you is, what gentle love and caution do you provide to anyone who is walking this journey about how to be kind with their choices?
Is to remind them that whatever the experience was that brought them there, try to strip them of that love for themselves. The biggest thing that you can do, give yourself a hug. Tell yourself what a wonderful thing you are. We don't call you a survivor for nothing. We call you a survivor because that's what you've done. And you're a warrior, and love yourself for that. Start there. And I trust you, that's just the beginning. Once you kind of just love yourself for that, the rest is cake.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Ruth. I think I love what you said, because I really took away about honoring your healing journey.
Yep.
No matter what that journey may look like, to honor your journey and to honor other people's and just to celebrate that you're healing,
that
you're on that path to healing.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
And Ruth, I wanted to ask you, you referenced a couple times your own path and you said you've been telling your story for 20 years, but I think it's always empowering for other women to hear women and to see somebody like you. You can tell you're successful. You've done a lot in your life. And for women to hear a story of survival and what you went through and how you got out. So tell me a little bit about when your story started 20 years ago.
Sure. I'll give you the short version. I met this person when I was 16. We got married and I thought he was, and you hear this quite frequently from other survivors, is I thought he was going to be the one that made life grand. And they don't marry you and tell you that I'm marrying you so that I can abuse you. They tell you that they love you and you want to be loved and you love them. So I had a son very young and we were married for 13 years. There was a lot of physical abuse in the marriage, a lot. And, you know, I've endured broken teeth, broken eye, or a black eye, or nine, strangulation, I mean, you name it. But what was most fearful in those 13 years is there was always a gun present in our home, always. It was very rare that he would pull it on me, but it was always about knowing the threat was there. I also want us to remember that it's abusers do not only physically abuse. And even outside of the emotional abuse that I talked about earlier, there's still that subtle power. You know, we see the movies where the guy's really powerful and, you know, blah, blah, blah. There are subtle forms of power. For instance, having a gun in the home and always knowing that he could make it happen. And he would leave it on the refrigerator or the nightstand just so I would know it was there. And he would say, just take one pull of the trigger and you're done. I finally, as supervisor of mine at work, and this is what I talk about being supportive. I called in sick one day after a pretty bad night being beaten. And she called me in and I thought she was going to fire me. And she did not. She said, I know what's going on. And I want you to know, I'm here for you if you ever need to get away. And she said, domestic violence. It's the first time I had thought about those words in context of myself. We weren't, anyway, I'll tell you about that in a minute. So that began my journey to safety. It took me 2 years to plan to leave. Mm-hmm. 2 years.
Yeah.
Both of us had good jobs. I had a 13-year-old son. You know, I was very, very fearful about what it would look like to be away from that. We forget when we're telling or asking survivors to leave. There's a lot of barriers and things they have to think about. Where am I going to put my child in school? Am I going to keep my job? Where's my money going to come from? He's always had the money. Do I have money? Yeah. So it's just not that easy. Oh, and by the way, I still love him. You know, just because this happened, the love doesn't go away. And you've got to reconcile that. And that takes time. So anyway, I left. Long story short, I was gone from him for about 6 months, and then he kidnapped me by gunpoint, held me hostage for about 4 hours, let me go. I was interrogated by the police because we were married, and then he got charged with felony kidnapping. And then about 2 months later, just before the court date, he followed me from my hiding place. He had been watching where I was, pulled up behind me, and shot me 3 times, and literally left me for dead. And it's really amazing. Because even then, and I'm hoping I'm speaking for all who have survived such traumatic events, even then you still can't believe it's happening. It's not like you're asking for it or you expect it. You care about this person. You didn't marry them or stay with them only because of the power that they have over you, the control. So you're just left going, what is this about? And then, of course, you know, trying to make sure he didn't get to my son, because at some point my son and I became synonymous. So if I was the problem, my son was the problem. He didn't. I came out of it with no lasting physical injuries. I got shot twice in the head.
Oh, my God.
My mom said, when she heard, she said, oh, my God, you've got the hardest head. So I laugh about it now, truly. But here's what was most amazing is that when this kind of came to, I was in the hospital for 3 days, mostly because they were trying to figure out where to hide me because he took off. He was on the run. 4 months later, they found him and he killed himself. And I got to tell you, we're talking about PTSD and we're talking about emotion and that kind of thing. The first one was deep relief, of course, because I could come out of hiding. The second one was deep grief. You have a person that you cared about. You don't want to see any person hurt themselves or hurt anybody else. And then after that, it took a while to kind of tie up my shoelaces. And I always wanted to go back to school. And I used to ask him, can I please just take night classes? And I decided that it was either really, really go down into this deep, dark hole of depression, which was natural, right? Or go in a little tiny hole of depression and figure out the rest of your life. So I went back to school, continued to raise my son. I was one of the lucky survivors who was able to keep her job and got my bachelor's and got my master's and decided that I was going to start working in domestic violence. I could see, I knew that I wouldn't be able to do direct service because of what we started this conversation with. There's too much PTSD. Right. I just wouldn't be able to do it. But I was hoping that I could do something like this to be able to make a difference. But, you know, we go back to that question that Melissa Hart asked. Yes. Which is, you know, why aren't we talking about it? And it is because we're not raising survivors' voices. I don't tell my story because I want to tell the story all the time, right?
Right.
I tell it because I want people to understand. I'm very proud of who I am, but there's a part of me that has a survivor fabric. And I'm hoping that I bring that to the work that I'm doing so people understand. No, you don't get to say that to a survivor. Or yes, we're paying a lot of hospital bills for survivors. So that's kind of my journey. I hope I didn't spend too long, but it is.
No. No, I think, you know, I keep thinking, as you said, that you kept thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening to me and that this is your life. And as you're laying there and you've been shot 3 times and he left you for dead.
Yep.
What went through your head at that point?
You know, quite frankly, it was the shock of, I can't believe this just happened. I knew that he was going to be violent when and if he ever caught up to me, but I didn't think it was going to be trying to kill me. Then my very next one was my son. And so I fell out of the car. He came around, shot me again. And then when I realized that he might be going back for my son, I actually got back in my car and drove about 500 yards to a gas station so somebody could go get my son. You know,
where was your son at that point?
He was back at the apartments with the neighbor friend. Because he went over to the neighbors, and I was going to go have dinner with a friend. I had been locked up, a COVID style, for weeks and months in hiding because I knew
right.
he was.
Right.
There's a lot of stalking and harassing that went on in that 6 months, a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I just finally said, I gotta have dinner. Right. I gotta get out of here. And my son had made really good friends with the neighbor, but I didn't know if he knew that or not. So I just needed somebody to go get my son. And they did. He was safe, too, by the way.
Oh,
but
my God.
My then-husband went immediately on the run for 4 months. So,
my gosh. You know, we started talking this interview about PTSD. And you said, if I heard you right, that you still hear triggers today. There are still things like the 4th of July today that send you right back there.
Yep. I don't like the 4th of July. You know, the first two shots were in my car. So there are, quite frankly, sometimes when I'm driving, something will happen and I kind of get hyperventilated about driving. Mm-hmm. Very rare, but it happens. And I've learned to recognize right. that as a trigger of some kind. The raising of a voice in a particular way. You know, I was at a restaurant once and I was like, oh my God, what is happening? And my friend just grabbed my hand and she said, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with you. I don't sit to my back with my back anywhere because the more movement behind me, the more anxious I get. You know, it's really fascinating because it's not necessarily associated to what exactly happened to you. That's why it's so similar.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point.
No matter what brought the PTSD, it's really about the hypervigilance, and it's really about the hyperactivity in your brain that's making you be guard. You have to be on guard. So my symptoms or anyone else's symptoms who have suffered violence as women would not be that different than somebody who's been in combat. And I would challenge us to think about that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's a conversation we need to have. because I think, like so many other kinds of abuse, there's so much shame around it.
Yeah.
And as survivors, we carry that shame.
Yeah.
And it's not ours to carry. And there should be, you know, we should be able to talk about PTSD and the honest effects that, I mean, for you, Ruth, I mean, it's been 20 years and things still trigger you. And, you know, to be able to have honest conversations about that, I hope is one of the things we're doing with this podcast to let women know you're not alone. You can be a survivor. You can be healing. You can be on a great path and yet still suffer sometimes still have triggers. And you can have done everything right.
I give my presentation. I've probably done 200 or 300 of them. And by the way, it's been 28 years.
28. Okay.
But I remind people, I am not 100% healthy and I'm okay with that.
Wow.
And today might be 90%, tomorrow might be 92, to the next day might be 63. But I'm okay with that because I did survive it. And I have to, part of me taking care of myself is understanding those 63% days or those 90% days. Mm. Now, to be clear, I don't necessarily like the 63% days, but I know they're coming.
I think I love that message because I think a lot of times we want our healing to be like this.
No.
And we just want to be done.
28 years later, and I can tell you there are times I still get in a fetal position in my bed and watch, you know, a silly movie because I just cannot cope. I can't. Mm-hmm. I know I can't be in the world. I know the world is not going to be kind to me today. I'm going to be kind to myself, and I got to stop and just do it.
Thank you, Ruth, for sharing. I love your vulnerability and I love the hope that you give too.
Thanks.
I want to say something about that because you just gave permission to all the survivors out there to breathe and be kind and gracious mm-hmm. to each and every one of us.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for what you did.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much.
That was beautiful. Yeah.
It really was. Ruth, we are so grateful to have had you join us today. Thank you for all the work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you. We appreciate the fact that, by the way, Ruth is with the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the CEO and president. And I appreciate all that you've given back by sharing your story, by the work that you're doing. The numbers are staggering and they can feel overwhelming, but hopefully, I mean, you know, all of us. Changing one person, one mind, helping one heart at a time. So thank you for what you're doing.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I'm Melissa Moore along with Melissa Faithhart. It is Your Voice, changing the conversation around domestic violence. I want to remind you, if you haven't gotten the eBodyGuard app yet to get it, it's absolutely free. The eBodyGuard app allows you by just yelling eBodyGuard now to call 911 and they can locate you within 3 meters. It is also, what's the word? I know, Melissa, you know the technical words since you created it, but it's FBI or what's it compliant so that when it's recorded?
FBI CJIS compliant and it records the scene of the crime. So at the same time, if something does happen to you, it will be provided in court so that it will help catch your perpetrator. Okay, and put him behind bars or her, but
absolutely
be able to keep you safe.
So. That's right. So get the app today. It's free. Get your friends and family to get it as well. And don't forget, you can get more information at ebodyguard.org. All right. For Melissa Moore, myself, Melissa Faithhart, thank you for joining us for this podcast.
For more information on domestic violence and trauma issues, visit ebodyguard.org. The eBodyGuard app is available at the Apple Store and Google Play. For help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the Domestic Violence Hotline can be reached at 1-800-799-SAFE.
Your Voice podcast is presented by the Public Affairs and News Department of Bonneville, Denver. Thank you for listening.